the book of Philippians. If you're already in the Tree of Life WhatsApp group, you will see that I sent a link to a 9-minute Bible project summary of the book of Philippians, which I think is really pretty good. Although the thing with mere mortals, they can make a video that takes 9 minutes to explain the book, but if you actually just read the book, it would take you about 15. So I think the first thing I kind of just wanted to say was I was really struck by the power of this letter. You know, a letter that, I don't know if you've ever read something that took 15 minutes to read, but this is an amazing letter. It's really a thank you letter. And when I say thank you letter, it immediately brings terror into my heart, because my family were very strict about thank you letters. Very strict. If you didn't send a thank you letter, man, you were in trouble. You would not get a gift the next year for your birthday. So I don't know if you had that experience when you were a thing, but if you give a gift to somebody and then you just disappears into the distance and you never get anything back, well, you don't regret giving the gift. You're still happy. When you get the letter back, the thank you letter, I gave a gift recently. We really like the gift, blah, blah, blah. It's sitting on our kitchen table and they sent me a picture of it. And what it engenders is a spirit of partnership. And in the sense, partnership is a really key theme in the book of Philippians. Really key theme, very important. The idea of actually us being in Messiah, being in partnership with the Messiah, but also being in partnership with each other. And generally speaking, it's the partnership with each other that is the messy end of the messianic movement. We can really push into the presence of God and seek to build our relationship with Him, but this letter will not allow us to do that without maintaining community. And although the Philippian letter is a love letter, it's a thank you letter, there's definitely stuff going on in this church that will be really familiar to you. And there's stuff going on in this church, outside the church, that will also be familiar to you. You're going to see, if you read through the text, you'll see like there's issues of disunity. There's envy and arguing and selfish ambition. And that's just amongst the leadership. I mean, of course, that doesn't happen at the Tree of Life, because Francis keeps us all under control. But thank goodness for Francis. And then, of course, Philippi is a Roman settlement. So if you think about Philippi, it's like, I don't know, think of it like the Isle of Wight, with a big military base on the Isle of Wight, and then lots of retirement homes where retired military people go, and everybody there is Roman. It's an expat Roman community. Everything's Roman, all the buildings, everything. Really, it's a really strong culture to be in. And then, so you're thinking that if you can think about like Rome, and if you just think of Rome, like, maybe you haven't been to China, but you could go to Chinatown in London and see a little bit of China, or you could go, you know, there's places you can go to which are like Legoland and see a little miniature village of something. That's what Philippi was like. It was like Rome on sea, except there wasn't a sea, but it was a little community outside that. And then you've got to see, well, then you kind of need to have a little dance into the book of Acts, into chapter 16, and see what happens in chapter 16, because that kind of tells us, that kind of gives us a picture that things don't start off well for poor Timothy. He's a believer and he's doing fine. But then he has to undergo adult male circumcision. And in a book about suffering, that's pretty appropriate as a starting place. But it gets worse for Timothy as the persecution begins. You will see in Acts 16, Paul and Silas being beaten and flogged. And as a result, being thrown into jail. And then there's the most unsuccessful prison break, I think, in the Bible. You know, no one escapes, but people get saved. It's fantastic. And there's also the story of Lydia's conversion. Now, whether Lydia was, it's my supposition that Lydia was part of a Jewish prayer group that met outside the town. Maybe there weren't enough people for a minyan to make a synagogue, but they had a group that met on a Saturday, and that generally seems to me to indicate a Jewish group. So you've got a group of Jewish people sitting outside the city. Paul comes up, preaches the gospel, and Lydia gets wholeheartedly saved and brings them into her home. So you already see, like, true salvation should lead to a heart for community. And you see that with Lydia. And I think also Luke, the writer of Acts, I think he's carefully put two households getting saved. One is a Jewish household that gets saved, and one, the jailer's household, is probably a Gentile household. So I think he's always showing us how the gospel drives disparate, different people together into community. And we know that when God pushes different, disparate people into community, that's something difficult. That's not going to be easy. It's not going to be straightforward. It's not going to be a great place for somebody who wants to be self-centered and have things their way and control things. It's going to require actually a different kind of personality. All that to be said, I think that the main, as I've been kind of looking at this text, I think the big question for me as I read the book is, it seems to be saying to us, can we maintain joyful unity for the sake of Messiah? Can we maintain joyful unity for the sake of Messiah? Because this is a book about pressure. I've already said that there was kind of disunity and ambition and arguments about and gossip and rivalry in the church. And I wonder whether Paul is concerned maybe that some private disagreements that exist at the back of the letter between Eutychus and Syntyche, who are gospel workers. I think he's concerned that their private disputes might spill out into public. And again, who's ever seen a church spoiled by private disputes spilling out into public? I mean, it's never happened in my... I've never... So I'm going to say, I suppose, rather unhelpfully, because we haven't even really got to the text, but I'm going to say, if you have a private dispute, if you can't sort it out, at least keep it private. I think that's a perfectly reasonable application from chapter 4. You know, we may have disagreements. I imagine on Saturday, if you come to the evangelism training that Warren and I are going to do, we may have disagreements between us, and there may be in this group, but for the sake of the gospel, we need to keep those private and actually work very hard at trying to understand the other person to minimize these conflicts, because conflicts will come, and they come because we're in a battle. As Steve said, we're secret agents, we're warriors for the Lord, and he's sent us out into battle. And sometimes it really feels like something like a scene out of World War One, where they're just sending us over the trench into the fire, into this kind of nowhere land where they're just going to be cut down by machine guns. But the book of Philippians just keeps pressing the Messiah button again and again and again. Paul uses the word Messiah about 36 times I think, 35 times, sorry, 35 times in the book. And something like 22 of those times, it's this phrase, in Messiah, that you're in Messiah. And that's, we have unity in Messiah. We don't have unity in flesh or in anything else, but through his spirit, we have unity in Messiah. And we are, as you would find out, we'd maybe look into in John's gospel, where Jesus prays that we would have this unity. And I think sort of maybe 16, 18, somewhere in John's gospel there. That's Paul's heart. He wants unity for us. And it's two directions. It's vertical and it's horizontal. So it's, you can't just have unity with God and live in your own little bubble. Just stay in your square on the screen and not have anything to do with the people that are around you. No, you can't do that. And you can't just be in the community. You can't just be in, like, you can't just be a busy person doing loads of stuff, painting things in the church, opening the hymn books, putting up the flowers, but not have a relationship with him. It's, you have to have both. You've really got to have both if you're going to maintain joyful unity for the sake of our Messiah, for his glory. Because it's, if you want to know anything about evangelism, is that you need a community for evangelism. I'm always delighted to be able to bring people to Tree of Life on a Monday, or to this event, even tonight. Because people who are not yet believers need to see community brought to life, and God has chosen you to bring his community to life on earth. And that's a high privilege. I think he'll say that he has chosen us to be stars that shine in the universe. You might not feel like a star that shines in the universe, but that is what he describes you as. So, with that little rambling introduction, let me read you chapter 2, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the first verses. So I'm going to read from chapter 2, verse 1 through to verse 18, and you'll see that it ends in a high. If you have any encouragement from being united with Messiah, if any comfort from his love, if any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. As you read and reread that text, if you have any encouragement, like if you have the slightest bit of encouragement, let God bring this tenderness and compassion out of you. We were talking earlier about people wanting rain to bring life to the gardens and to the flowers. Let God pour the water of his spirit, if you like, onto you to create tenderness and compassion. And see that, obviously, there is selfish ambition, vain conceit going on in the church. Otherwise, he wouldn't be telling you not to do it. So there's always going to be this battle, isn't there, between the spirit and the flesh. They oppose each other, Paul says elsewhere. But he says, if you've got any encouragement from being united with Messiah, from your name being written in the book of life for this eternal paradise that we are destined for here on earth, if you've got any sense of hope in that, then be humble and consider others as better than yourself. That is seriously hard, isn't it? That's a real challenge. because we are all prone to think of ourselves first. That's what we are. We have a flesh that's very much active. So what are we going to do in the face of this almost impossible task for people like me? Many of you may be good, nice people, and so it doesn't seem so challenging. But for the less wonderful people in the group, what we need is a big hope, a big thing in the distance to see, something that will give us the courage to live lives that are pleasing in God's sight and that reveal something different about us. And this is what we're given in chapter 2. Your attitude should be the same as that of Messiah Jesus, who, being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a slave, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus, at the name of Yeshua, every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Yeshua, that Jesus, Messiah, is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Therefore, dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. Do everything without complaining or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure children of God, without fault in a crooked generation, in which you shine like stars in the universe, as you hold out the word of life, in order that I may boast on the day of Messiah that I did not run or labor for nothing. But even as I am being poured out like a drink offering on the sacrifice and the service coming from your faith, I am glad and rejoice with all of you. So you too should be glad and rejoice with me. Look at those first, maybe if you look to the first verse 5, 6, and 7, perhaps it's helpful to see this second Adam being described, who, being the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped. It reminds me of Adam and Eve grasping at the tree. They weren't equal with God, and yet they sought. The temptation was that they fell because they sought to be equal with God when they weren't. But here we have a Messiah who is by his very nature the one God that Steve was talking about earlier, the one that made all things, the only true God. And this is kind of important for us, as it was important for Philippi, because they lived in the same kind of environment as we live in, with all these multiple gods and multiple kings. And it was okay for you to say you believe in Jesus, but it's not okay for you to say that Islam is a false religion and that Jewish people need to believe in Jesus. No, you can't say that. All roads lead to, it was exactly this thing of all roads lead to God if you want to find him. But here we are discovering that this Messiah is by his very nature God. And though he is by his very nature God, he doesn't choose to grasp that for his own benefit. But what does he do? He made himself nothing, taking the nature of a servant or a slave, being made in human likeness. I think it's just worth pausing to take in the sacrifice that that meant. The what he was giving up. We can't imagine what it would be to be him. But the next time, in the course of your next week, when you're looking, when you're in a situation and you, like, I don't know, could be anything, could be, for some reason in my mind, I'm thinking about when I'm walking along the road going to buy some food and I see somebody outside the shop begging and I say to myself, oh, they don't really need the money because I want to go in and buy something. Because I want to hang on to I want to grasp and hang on to things. I don't want to be open-handed. I'll be open-handed when it suits me. Well, it suited the Messiah Yeshua to be open-handed because he loved you. Because he could see what it would achieve. He knew that the only way you could shine like stars is if you were in him, if you were clothed in him, if he somehow covered you with his wing. And he'll do, and that's the beginning of his work, which you will see through to completion. But it is really our hope, only hope, and it's the only hope of any person that's living. He made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And as we begin to think about the Messiah being made in human likeness, then that should draw us to Isaiah chapter 53, this famous chapter, where we see this servant being humbled. And that I can't take you to Isaiah 53, but I never get tired of looking at it, because Paul obviously had, this is like a little precis in a way of Isaiah 53. He says, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Now, why does he say death? I mean, death on a cross. Why is that important? Why would that be important? He's in Philippi. If he's writing to people who are in Philippi, and no Roman citizen can ever be crucified. It's one of the rights of being a Roman citizen is that you can't be crucified. And so here are these people, they're worshiping a crucified God in a place where it's the lowest possible thing that could happen to a person. And so as they're going around in Philippi sharing their faith, the people say, well, no, it can't be God. God, that's the lowest. And then they say, yes, exactly. Our God was willing to utterly humiliate himself in public in order to rescue you. And he would have done it just for one of you. And some of you might not feel particularly valuable. I tell you, try to understand that the sovereign creator of the universe became flesh and died for you in the most horrible, shameful, humiliating way in order that he could transform you from an object of his wrath into an object of his love. Into someone who is destined, who like John 3 says, you know, we're all born into destruction. And he brings us out into life. He doesn't judge us, he rescues us. We've already been judged. We're already guilty. He doesn't say we're guilty. He says, come, I'm going to lead you out. It's a prison break story. And he's the only key guy with the key that can unlock you from your sin and your pain and suffering and bring you out into the light. And so, because it says in verse 9, therefore God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name above every name, that the name of Jesus every knee should bow. And again, that's probably kind of very familiar Revelation language to most of us. Revelation is the last book of the New Testament. It points us to this climactic vision of a world where there's no pain, suffering, or death, where everything is made right, where Eden is restored and where worship continues forever. But it's, you can see both those things in the book of Isaiah, and you can particularly see every knee bowing, or the prophecy that every knee will bow, in Isaiah 45:23. And see that this Messiah, this Yeshua, this Jesus, every knee is going to bow in heaven and on earth and under earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus is the Messiah. He's the Lord, to the glory of the Father. Paul delights in his Trinitarian God. Paul delights in his Trinitarian God. The Echad, the one, the plural one, he absolutely loves it. You know, as he's, if you flick over into chapter 3, you know, he has this massive kind of thing where he says, what does he say? If anyone thinks he has reason to put confidence in the flesh, I have more, circumcised on the eighth day, of the people of Israel, tribe of Benjamin, Hebrew of Hebrews, regard to the law of Pharisee, for zeal persecuting the church, legalistically righteous. And then he says, but whatever I considered to be my profit, I considered to be lost for the sake of Messiah. Everything he did was just nothing compared to what God had done for him, what his Messiah had done for him. I can't imagine how overwhelmed with joy he must have been as Yeshua led him through Bible study after Bible study in his exile. And as he was, you know, it just must have been the most incredible thing, because he was so on fire for God and so wrong. Therefore, dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. It's not that God fear in this context and trembling is not like, it's not like the other day when a big dog, black dog, came running towards me across the park and I was fear and trembling because I didn't know what was going to happen. This is wonder, and like the trembling that Lynn feels when she looks into Michael's eyes, or I don't know, certainly doesn't, but you know the excitement you might feel when if you got tickets to meet one of your favorite stars, or if you discovered that your favorite author was in town and they wanted to meet you. It's that kind of wonderful. And then it makes more sense when he says, for it's God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. See, our difficulty is not doing things. Our difficulty is fear of dependence on him to do things through us. Does that make sense? To, you know, I personally can tell you that the thing I most fear is being dependent on other people. Some people have like garages full of things so that they never have to be dependent on anyone. They've always got a carpet tool. Michael, see, okay, I'm talking about Michael, but only because he's a good illustration. You know, like, we all live our lives like Michael. We've all got like a garage full of things that help us feel valuable and independent and able to do stuff. But actually, we sang earlier about the what we really need in our garage is a relationship with God and a commitment to loving other people, regardless of what they do to us. And when we have a relationship with God and a commitment to other people, that is that we're going to love them regardless of what they do to us, then you're going to shine like stars and no one's going to stop the gospel. And it all comes by putting aside self, by not grasping at what the world has to offer, and by walking through life, seeing failure and victory, they're both irrelevant compared to this gospel that we've got. Last little story. When I was first saved, I was very much more zealous than I am now. Calmed down so much now about the whole thing. But I remember being on the tube in central London, probably on the Northern Line, and it's probably summer, and I'm probably rushing down because I'm probably late and I'm rushing to get somewhere. And I ram myself onto the train, and it's all squashed like this, everyone squashed in. Remember that kind of crazy commuting that everyone forced themselves to do? And it squashed in like that. And there was a woman next to me, and she was a bit upset about this crowded tube station. And I had just learned, I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether it's well-fed or hungry, or whether I'm living in plenty or want. I can do everything through him who strengthens me. And I just rolled it off my tongue like that. And she said to me, "Are you bloody mad?" Oh, sorry if I've offended anyone. But she thought I was completely crazy. And actually, maybe she was right. Because it's not a matter of memorizing scripture and being able to drop it in inappropriate moments like that on the tube. It's about life in Messiah and about life in community with him. And we can only do it by being dependent on him and by trusting him. It's the only way we can do it. And it's the only way we can genuinely produce the fruit that he wants us to produce. So I guess we need to pray that under the pressure from all sides that we face, that the Lord would help us to maintain joyful unity for the sake of the Messiah and his promise. Because at quite two or three occasions in this book, Paul makes reference to this coming day of the Messiah, where he wants to be proud and see this Philippian church and these Philippian believers in the last day when all things are resurrected. And it's kind of difficult, isn't it, in this online world, but although we're getting more opportunities to be with each other, I think I'd really encourage you to keep an equal balance between fellowship with him, quiet time, whatever, however that works, walking and praying, whatever, looking at nature. I found this in the park today. It's so cool. It's like, can you imagine? I can't even tell you how long even Michael would take a long time to make one of these. Look at that. Look how brilliantly, I mean, however you see the beauty of his creation, or however you get close to God, you do that. But it's not enough just to get close to God. You've got to get close to people. And when you say, "Yeah, but I don't really like people," like I say all the time, he says, "Yeah, well, deal with it. I came out of eternity to make this possible. Now just get on with it." And when you obey him against your will or against your flesh, he loves to bless that. I think he's like, as he was very kind to me with Gwen, when I was again rushing to come and speak and Gwen's car was in my way, and in God's grace, I restrained myself, which was jolly good, because when I was speaking, if Gwen had been sitting at the front, she would have thrown rotten tomatoes at me when I was speaking. So there's the encouragement. The encouragement is the gospel's true. It's brilliantly described in Philippians 2. It'll take you 15 minutes to read Philippians. And if you read it once a week for, a month or something, it'll transform you. And you won't just be able to recite scripture like that. You'll actually want to put it into practice and see God at work with you as you know, he talks about come to me, all you weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest, rest for your soul. His burden is light and his yoke is easy. He wants to walk with you as a yoke fellow, but you've got to walk. You got to be in the game to play with the football. And he really wants you to do that. But he doesn't want you just to do stuff. He wants you to spend time with him as well. And when you spend time with him and then you do stuff with him, it's going to be great. And we're going to shine like stars and everyone's going to be. And we're in like a really amazing special time. Just last week, because of lockdown, my wife got her hair done by a mobile hairdresser who's cut the hair of our next door neighbor for years. And the lady turned up. She had a tattoo on her arm that said the Tree of Life underneath it. I looked at the logo on the WhatsApp group, and I'm sure that the logo on the WhatsApp group is almost identical to the tattoo on her arm. And when I was talking to her later on, after she'd finished cutting my wife's hair, she told me how she was Jewish. And then we started talking, and she's really interested in spiritual things. I mean, she's one of the most open Jewish people I've met for years. So I think we're in a really special time. And just hold on to the truth of the gospel. When you get the chance to be out, just love people and watch God open doors. And I think that's all I want to say.